invest this much money and offset your crime of your flying. Plant a mango tree somewhere in India or Africa, and that gives you freedom to fly. That kind of straight equations, it appeals to people who do not want to look at the harder solutions. That would mean a lot of sacrifices, a lot of change in their own consumerist lifestyles. I think this message should go to northern people, actually. Instead of looking at the false answers, they should really think about what's happening.
Welcome to the 2 Degrees Show, the UK's only weekly programme dedicated to climate change. This week, we'll be taking a critical look at the flexible mechanisms of the Kyoto Protocol. In an opinion piece for the Guardian newspaper in 2001, Mark Lynas calculated that these flexible mechanisms, introduced into the protocol largely at the behest of the United States in 1997, would mean that instead of resulting in a 5.2% cut in emissions by industrialised countries, they could instead lead to a net increase in emissions by those countries. The carbon market that is emerging today as a result of these provisions is expanding rapidly. One intended outcome is the transfer of clean technologies to developing countries. But are we seeing genuine sustainable development projects, or are we seeing subsidies for industries that are already having significant adverse impacts on local communities, and which allow them to expand their negative sphere of influence? A new book has just been published, which is the most definitive critique on this topic to date. Carbon Trading by Larry Lohman is distributed in the UK by Carbon Trade Watch, and I spoke to one of the collective's London-based members, Kevin Smith, to find out more about what's going on.
The flexible mechanisms are established in Kyoto were basically a means of making the emissions reductions more cost-effective, both for industry and governments. This was done through three different ways. The first was emissions trading, which is basically if someone else, another industry, can make an emissions reduction more cost-effectively than you somewhere else, instead of having to make that cut in your emissions yourself, you could then effectively buy that emissions reduction off the other person. The second flexible mechanism is the Clean Development Mechanism, the CDM. The Kyoto's protocols split up into the Annex 1 and the Annex 2 countries. The Annex 1 countries are the more developed or richer countries, industrialized countries in the global north, and the Annex 2 countries, that includes groups like Brazil, it also includes a lot of the kind of really impoverished sub-Saharan African countries. But the Annex 2 countries are those ones which aren't yet committed to reducing emissions in this current commitment period under Kyoto. So a clean development mechanism involves an Annex 1 country implementing some kind of clean energy or emissions reductions project in an Annex 2 country, and then the credits that are generated from that project can be purchased and used by an Annex 1 country in order to contribute towards their compliance target. The third mechanism is a joint implementation, which is similar to the clean development mechanism, but instead it involves a project between two Annex 1 countries. Say, for instance, a company in Britain could institute a joint implementation project in an Eastern European country.
Right, I mean, one question I did want to ask was, to what extent these flexible mechanisms impact on the 5.2% emissions reductions target? Does it actually weaken that target?
The reduction target is compromised to the point of meaningless, given the fact that governments and industry can buy their way out of their commitment to this reduction. The immensity of the challenge in front of us in climate change means that there's very profound changes that need to be made into our economies, to our industry, to our lifestyles, and so on. And that there aren't any kind of magic solutions to that, and it's not easy, and it is expensive. And the existence of these flexible mechanisms are ultimately just delaying the implementation of these changes that need to happen into our society.
What about the kind of CDM projects that are being implemented at the moment? They're the cheapest ones, but not necessarily the most effective in terms of reducing emissions.
I think when people have the idea of CDM projects, they have this idea that the CDM's all about developing lots of progressive, community-based renewables energy projects in the global south, and people think there's lots of windmills and micro-hydro projects. The reality of the situation is renewable projects take up a tiny fraction of the number of CDM projects that have been approved, mainly because these sorts of projects are much more expensive to implement than the projects which involve adjusting industry process in big factories and power plants. So the vast majority of CDM projects are based on hydrofluorocarbon adjustments. Hydrofluorocarbons, or HFCs, as a greenhouse gas, they're incredibly damaging. And there's a relatively cheap way of adjusting industrial processes to destroy HFCs as part of that process. And this is a CDM project, generates enormous amounts of credits, and it's relatively cheap to do compared with the renewable energies. Unfortunately, instead of kind of promoting alternative energy sources, this is just propping up industrial processes which are already heavily dependent on fossil fuels. So it's kind of tinkering with the system rather than promoting the more structural change that's needed in the transition to the low carbon economy. It's also contrary to the supposed development agenda of the CDM. It's called the Clean Development Mechanism, and all the projects that are implemented are supposed to have some sort of sustainable development component that contributes to local communities and so forth. In practice, this is just window dressing, which serves to kind of prop up the existence of the mechanism. Because as we can see from the HFC projects, it's just like bolting some extra machinery into the factory, and it's got no development benefits whatsoever to the countries or communities. CDM projects require a lot of time, money, and specialist knowledge in the application and the project process. And that means that the kind of projects are automatically skewed in favor of large corporations who have access to the resources to do that sort of thing. So the kind of the grassroots community-based projects based on renewable energy and so forth, they're excluded from the CDM because the transaction costs are far too high for them to be able to take part in it. Thus, the projects are heavily concentrated amongst the big industry and big energy companies. And often it's the case that these are the companies that are the subject of protest of local communities for the various kind of pollution and land rights issues that's going on as part of that. One example of that in India is a steel company called Jindal Steel and Power, which has one of the biggest sponge iron plants in the world. It's an enormous plant that's spread over 320 hectares, and it's wiped out the agricultural village that used to be on the site. And it wants to expand over three surrounding villages. And it's also been the subject of a lot of process in terms of the water levels it's depleted as part of its industrial process. And villagers from 18 local communities are opposing a dam for over a decade that it wants to build. Now, this is the type of plant that's benefiting from the CDM process and generating enormous amounts of credits through the CDM process, but is also the subject of huge controversy to the kind of local communities who've lost their land and are being pressured to kind of give up more of their land in order to accede to the expansion of the plant. So it might look fine on paper in terms of generating carbon reductions, but it's kind of neatly sidelining the local communities and their opposition to such a plant, and it's kind of giving it more legitimacy and more income.
Surely that's a large part of the problem with these CDM projects, is that there is a lack of verification, a lack of proper regulation. These projects, they can be done with little oversight and get away with quite a lot of what wouldn't be acceptable in our own countries.
The thing is, there's so much incentive for both the purchasers of credits and the suppliers of credits to exaggerate certain factors to make it more profitable to themselves. On top of this, there's the concept of additionality in the Clean Development Mechanism. That is, you have to ensure that without your funding for the project wouldn't have been able to happen. But the fact is that it's impossible to kind of predict what the factors are in the future that might have made the project happen anyway, such as a change of government legislation or so forth.
So is it just a problem that the CDM is in its infancy and that teething problems will be kind of ironed out, or do you think it's endemic? On the other hand, you could argue that since it's so small, it should be relatively easy to monitor, and if it grows to the kind of levels which people are currently projecting, then it's going to get completely unmanageable.
I mean, there's already been so many kind of problems associated with all aspects of the project's implementations, and at the moment they're really kind of pushing to have the process streamlined even more, which to me sounds like pushing more projects through without being quite so stringent on the checking. So I think the problem in terms of the dodginess of individual projects is only going to grow and be more prolific in the market.
I mean, I think one argument that people also might come up with, which would be that what you're doing with these flexible mechanisms is harnessing the power of the market to solve some of these problems. You can't ignore the market, you have to kind of deal with it. And industry is resistant, you know, you've got vested interests, they're resistant to change. This is one way of bringing them on board and trying to use that power in a positive way.
I think you're bringing them on board essentially on their terms. The whole Kyoto process has been diluted to the point of meaningless in order to be able to bring business on board. And I think at some point you have to take a firm stand to that and say, and we are saying that there has to be a very fundamental restructuring of the relationship to business and government and the interests of people all over the world in order to deal with climate change. And I'm not sure if kind of continuing to pander to business in this kind of way is effective in the short or long term. I think the sooner we make the necessary political changes to address the preponderance of corporate self-interest in our political system, that's when we're going to be at the point when we start to meaningfully deal with climate change. We've seen how this kind of market-based agenda has failed people the world over in terms of privatization regimes, in terms of structural adjustment programs, and in terms of the growth of inequality under classical neoliberal economics. And now we're asking for the kind of same sort of economic policies to be addressed to the single biggest threat we kind of collectively face on the planet. And it's an incredibly risky strategy to take when we could be using more tested, tried and true policies such as ending subsidies to the fossil fuel industries, government regulation, upstream environmental taxation and so forth. And this might be kind of politically unfashionable, but I think it's the most important tools we have. And we should be combining this with supporting the sort of social movements who are resisting the fossil fuel industry in various parts of the world. And it's this sort of thing which can be incredibly effective in dealing with climate change, which is totally sidelined and marginalised with all the focus that goes on to the flexible mechanisms in Kyoto.
That was Kevin Smith of Carbon Trade Watch. To get a more direct appraisal of what's going on from a developing country perspective, I spoke to Sumitra Ghosh. He's the secretary of the Northeastern Society for the Preservation of Nature in West Bengal, and also a representative for the National Forum of Forest Peoples and Forest Workers. Sumitra has been working on a study of how the CDM projects are impacting across India, and his research to date is summarised in Larry Lohman's carbon trading book. India has the most CDM projects of any country in the world, and 85% of these CDM projects are hydrofluorocarbon destruction projects. I asked Sumitra what benefits there were in terms of sustainable development from these HFC destruction projects.
In most of the places, these projects, you know, are impacting disastrously on communities. I mean, there's significant environmental impact, social impact, economic impact. In fact, the projects are doing precisely the opposite of what they're claiming to do.
In the case of the HFC projects, there's been reports of air pollution and water pollution and the groundwater levels being lowered. Yeah. That's also the case for sponge iron, which I believe, which you've had more direct experience of.
And also people are getting displaced from their lands, which they rely on for their livelihoods. Could you tell us a bit about perhaps one project in particular?
I can tell you about two projects. There's a cluster of windmill projects, wind power projects in Maharashtra. Right now there are 9-10 registered projects, and more are coming up. A whole valley, a whole mountainside was covered by windmills. And everywhere, in each single case, you know, this is a question of clear land grab. I mean, people, land was obtained from people under false pretenses. And none of the people who interviewed was even remotely aware that such a project is going to come. And not only that, and in many cases that, you know, the company is in direct confrontation with the community. Because these common property resources of the people, like in the village pastures and things like that, were taken over by the companies to start these windmills. And in many places, there's conflicts are going on, in fact, now, right now. In one particular case, I remember that the company has even gone that far to threaten people with their lives and, you know, livelihood and security and things like that. It was, in fact, a clear violation of people's daily lives and their security. You know, the company is directly threatening them. It's employing goons and you know, hoodlums on hire. So we have investigated that thoroughly. And the Jindal case is typical of Chhattisgarh, where a number of sponge iron projects have come up. And each case that before they applied for CDM, these have been number of times it happened that these projects have been fined by the regulatory authority, the Pollution Control Board, for chronic pollution. They refuse to obey, they comply with the norms. Like the sponge iron companies, they emit a lot of, you know, toxic fly ash and a lot of carbon gas into the air.
Mm.
And we recently visited one site near Chhattisgarh capital, Raipur, and the whole, there was an industrial complex that that has about 14 sponge iron companies, units located in a very small area.
Mm.
And the whole air is so foul with, you know, this coal dust and ash and everything. But legally, I mean, each company is supposed to operate a thing called electrostatic precipitator, which is a pollution controlling mechanism.
Okay. Is that also the technology that is supposed to take out the carbon?
It's very much part of that technology, which they are claiming that it's a city of clean technology.
Right.
They are saying that they are in fact reducing their waste heat. There was this flue gas that the projects generate. They are channelizing that through a chamber, and they are burning it to generate waste heat, and then passing it onto a turbine to generate power.
Right.
As part of that, you know, residue is supposed to go to this electrostatic precipitator, the ESPs, which would then sort of filter it and release, you know, whiter smoke, I mean, less foul smoke into the air.
Mm.
And these ESPs are supposed to be operated in three shifts, day and night. But these are mostly not operated or operated only partially. I mean, some companies operate like Jindal, they sometimes operate in day, but in nights mostly because there is nobody to look at it. No vigilance, no, you know, monitoring.
Mm.
And they mostly remain shut down.
Right.
And pollution is going on as usual. And Jindal is particularly bad because it's a huge project. There are many units. In fact, they have taken up so much land from people. And in each of the project, the project authorities and the local people, the communities, are, you know, on a warpath. But these sponge iron companies are very, you know, bad. I mean, these projects are in Chhattisgarh, in a neighboring state like Orissa, in Jharkhand, in West Bengal. They're everywhere.
But these factories have been involved, like you say, in dispossessing people of their lands.
Yeah,
sure. So, what do people end up doing? I mean,
people are resisting. We have seen cases that people have stopped the companies from acquiring land. And
yeah.
But this question of expanding operations are being resisted.
Right. In the case where lands have been taken away for plants, like I believe one of the Jindal plants is on the site of an agricultural village. Surely that's kind of creating refugees or migrants, and these people presumably were living in a way that was relatively sustainable.
Most people were dispossessed, they get lost, you know. It's very difficult to trace them. It's very difficult to trace where they go. Sometimes, yeah, some people go and they, you know, send some money back home. And the price they paid for this, acquiring this land, it's so meager. It's hardly anything. And
yeah.
From agricultural land, it gives you sort of food, you know, for some months a year.
Yes.
And that security is taken away from you.
Yes. Yeah, that was the point I was making, that their lifestyle before they were dispossessed was probably relatively sustainable.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even it's not 100% sustainable, but it's at least better than this now, what's happening now.
And community consultation, there's been a couple of proven cases where people involved in these projects have been found to falsify documents relating to community consultation to make it look as if the community is supporting it when in fact they're not.
That's a standard practice. Jindal, in one of the Jindal projects that has been done, actually is a formal consent from the local, you know, village self-government. In one case, it has been proved that, you know, this the signature has been forged. A signature of the head man of the village council has been forged.
Looking to the future, I mean, it seems that the carbon market is just about to take off. So unless these projects are tightened up a lot, you and your peoples could be in line for a lot worse.
I know.
Carbon forestry looks like one thing which might be very big.
Yeah, I mean, it's coming. It's coming perhaps in a big way. UNFCCC hasn't cleared any project officially, but I think World Bank is going for it in a big way. And for us, at least, you know, UNFCCC projects are bad. I mean, but there is at least some regulatory body process which you can trace, where you can appeal, which you can criticize or censor. But there is this whole carbon market outside in UNFCCC. I mean, this retail carbon market, the voluntary offsets, things like that.
Yes, are you seeing?
And, yeah, I mean, it's almost impossible to trace and where this money is going, who is investing, where, how.
Mm.
And carbon forestry projects is dangerous for India because Indian government is eyeing that, you know, money.
Mm.
They have already a plan to plant 30 million hectares with eucalyptus and similar kind of plantation.
Right.
And the giant corporation called Indian Tobacco Company, the ITC, they have this huge paper and pulp. They are the leading paper manufacturer and pulp company. So they have already 100,000 hectares of eucalyptus plantation. So they want to increase that area, and they are, in fact, the main force behind the lobby, which is pressurizing the Indian government to give them a degraded forest land, a so-called degraded forest land, for raising plantations.
Right.
And World Bank is promoting all this. I mean, it's in fact, it's being done at World Bank's PS. And the Indian government has almost readied a kind of a blueprint by which the forest land would be handed over to these corporates for raising plantations, ostensibly for community benefit.
But what will it mean in reality?
It would mean in reality, you know, this whole forest, which is a state property right now in India, would be privatized. So they're calling it a public-private partnership. It's waiting approval. It's not yet official. But they're trying their level best to do it. And even if UNFCCC doesn't clear a project officially, there is a huge market outside, and it's growing.
Mm.
I mean, this retail market. And this carbon forestry credits can be sold in the market.
And again, is that resulting in land grabs from people that are already living on the land?
Yeah, yeah. In many cases, it's a nexus between the forest department and the ITC officials. And their agents go from village to village trying to convince people that if you, stop your whatever crops you are raising right now, the traditional crops, and switch over to eucalyptus, you'll earn a lot more. So that's the standard rhetoric they give.
Right.
And the cases we have investigated, it's all in future. I mean, some people have given land. But, you know, India is a very feudal country in many areas. In fact, there's less landowner than a lot of land-dependent people, sharecroppers, like people, intermediaries and, you know, tenants, sub-tenants, and these landless peasants, agricultural workers. So this whole body of people are losing. So even if the landowner, you know, for lured by the quick money or convinced by the rhetoric, even if he gives that his land, the whole people who are associated with that land, who live on that land, they lose. In fact, because land, when it goes under eucalyptus, it doesn't provide any job. It doesn't provide any food. So at least, you know, at best, it would provide a week's job to the local people, some of the local people, not all of them. And that too for 1 or 2 years, first 2 years. Once the trees grow up to a point, you know, they do not require any tending or any looking after. Yeah. They just grow.
Have you come across any examples of good projects that have been funded by the CDM?
I haven't, unfortunately. No. To us, market doesn't provide any answers. It's a market which is emerging at the cost of people's lives and livelihoods and lands. The answer has to be sought outside the market. So that's the main point. I mean, you cannot let the market solve something as big as the climate crisis. The market doesn't have any answer. Market has its own answer. Market produces profits. Profits for corporations, profits for brokers, profits for, you know, consultancy firms. So you'll have to dissociate the whole discourse of climate crisis and changing environment from the marketplace.
That was Sumitra Ghosh speaking on the phone earlier this week from West Bengal. That brings this week's 2 Degrees show to a close, but we'll continue our look at carbon trading next week when we'll be putting these criticisms to some of those involved in the trade. Can the Kyoto Protocol flexible mechanisms be reformed, or should they be abolished? In the meantime, you can find Larry Lohman's carbon trading book in PDF form on the web at www.thecornerhouse.org.uk. That's www.thecornerhouse.org.uk. And if you want to hear today's show again, you'll find it archived at coinnet.org.uk/climate radio. That's coinnet.org.uk/climate radio.